Welcome. Today is the 24th of September, 2014, and this is the fifth edition of the Ades Opere podcast here with Ryan Grant and Athanasius Contramundum. Today, what I've decided to do is to put together some emails and comments in different subjects, and I'm out here on my porch with in this nice fall day, so if you hear a little background noise, that's probably what it's going to be. Although I've just upgraded some of my hardware, I'm very pleased to say. And so the old cheap Radio Shack microphone I used to have is now a thing of the past. I can't believe I ever tried to do anything with that. So this thing so far seems to be working out. All my tests have been coming out pretty good. So this will be a regular feature depending on how many questions and what type of things I get from people. So the first one is of a historical nature. It's from Bill Jarrett. He asks, "You said that you're a military historian, and I wanted to get your take on a few things. First, France had a much larger population than England, but you know, England trounced France in both the War of Spanish Succession and the Seven Years' War. Why is that? Did the French generals suck that bad? Second, why were the Stuarts so weak and the Hanoverians so strong? Thanks, Bill." Okay, Bill, it's a great question, great historical question. You know, how is it that the French, with their empire, Louis XIV, the Sun King, 20 million Frenchmen, you know, compared to the meager population of England, well, how is it the English beat his butt so bad? And then later, also in the Seven Years' War, all over the continent, there and the world, actually, there's different reasons for it. Some things deal with politics and finance and economy. So I'm going to come at it from two angles. So first is in terms of military tactics. So we take the War of Spanish Succession. It was one of those wars that nobody wanted, but except for the English, and it came around anyway. That was Charles the Second of Spain, unless I'm mistaken. Was childless, less Habsburg king, and so the Cortes in Madrid had voted for, as well as in Aragon, had voted for the new monarch to come from the Bourbon family, to be one of Louis XIV's grandsons. And as long as the pledge was that Spain and France, the two crowns, would not be united in one sovereign. Well, the Habsburgs weren't pleased about that over in Austria, because that meant that all the wealth of all the New World possessions was going to leave the family. Not that it was doing Spain all that much good, but that's for another time. And then the English didn't want to see Louis XIV gain, you know, control, albeit through a relative, of the New World and all its possessions. So he decided that, William of Orange, all the Protestants, they decided, we're not going to tolerate this. Of course, William of Orange died before the thing could get started, so it fell to his sister-in-law, Anne Stuart, to carry it out. Now, the tactics at the time, the English army was, its creation as a force, it was kind of this haphazard affair. It waxed and waned at different points. The English were nervous about standing armies because of the English Civil War and the effect of Cromwell, and then the restored Stuart monarchy had standing armies because they were never sure if they were actually secure after what had happened with Cromwell. So the English army was kind of brought into existence by seasoned commanders such as the Duke of Marlborough, Lord Churchill, who's an ancestor of Winston Churchill. And he got into the fray because his wife, Sarah Churchill, was very good friends with Queen Anne. And so Churchill had a prominent place in the war. So one of the things that Churchill did was absolute genius in terms of tactics. Churchill had innovated a new infantry tactic with guns. Now, the way the guns worked in this time is you had a thing called the matchlock. And the way that worked was, you conceive of like a Revolutionary War type rifle, and you have this little tray you pull out, and you have this burning match, which is actually a piece of cord soaked in pitch. And you have to keep that away from the pan, or you're going to blow yourself up. You put a little bit of primer in there, close that, then you ramrod your the ball in your powder in, just like you see in, say, even Civil War movies. And, you know, then you have to attach your match to the trigger mechanism. So when you pull the trigger, it pulls this match into the pan, ignites the pan, ignites the gunpowder inside the barrel, and sends that ball going out the end. And that was a very bulky way to work. So you would have five or six ranks of guys who were constantly at different times ready to load and would come forward and shoot and then get back and everything. The French never mastered really the tactic with that. They used to use the sheer force of numbers. So the French would fight with their massed infantry in about six or seven ranks of soldiers deep. And that's how a lot of the armies tended to fight this way. Now, a new technology increased the speed with which you could reload and change, and this is called the flintlock, which is the same weapon, substantially, that was used in the American Revolutionary War. So of course, that cuts out the problem with the match and keeping your matches lit and all these types of things. It cuts out, the other problems you have to have is there simply the flint itself, striking the flint, ignites inside the barrel. And they'd had this technology before, but now it was being mass-produced. So but the French were slow to pick up on this universally. So the French had a mix of, you know, of the old matchlocks as well as the new flintlock. So the English made sure that they were completely equipped to the flintlock, and Marlborough innovated this tactic. And this is principally the thing that wins the war for the English and their allies, because he taught the Dutch the same thing, and likewise the Germans. Fight in three ranks deep. So your first rank fires, and it allows a wider plane too. So with your ranks more concentrated width-wise as opposed to depth-wise, which is how massed infantry fights with pikes, you see. And that's where the tactic with the soldiers just carries over from the pike warfare. Well, Marble changes that. Lined up in a wide swath with three ranks, first rank fires, steps back, second rank fires, steps back, third rank fires, steps back. Then the first rank, which in that time has reloaded, steps up, fires. And what this allowed Marble to do that the French were never able to match was to give a sustained level of firepower on the French troops. And it was absolutely devastating in terms of French casualties. All the major battles were a terrible loss. And then, of course, the tactics play into it as well, particularly Blenheim, where Marble defeated a French army, you know, several times the size of his coalition. And it's a difficult thing to trace, and I can't even go into it just now, but I need maps and pictures to really get a sense of how he did it. Also, Malcapet and many other battlefields. So he'd done a brilliant job. And the French, you know, by the weight of numbers, were able to hang into the war, because if it was a smaller nation, they'd have been toast. And their infantry also helped them a good bit as well. But that's another story. So that's principally why. And the same problem comes to the fore in the Seven Years' War, where, you know, the French have the better in terms of artillery, and in this time their navy has finally caught up to be nearly the equal of the English. And you'll especially see that in the American Revolutionary War, when the French intervene, that they actually defeat the English several times. And then just as the French get their navy to the height, then you have the French Revolution, and they purge all the old aristocratic commanders and put in, you know, bakers and butchers and tailors to now be the new admirals, and they haven't a clue how to run ships, and the French Navy goes way down in its fighting abilities. So anyway, in the Seven Years' War is the same thing. And there's also another thing, too, is that the French commanders tended to be more cautious. They tended to fail to observe that military maxim: don't plan for what the enemy won't do, plan for what he could do. And of course, the French failed in this quite a bit, so that, like in Quebec, the British just stormed up into the citadel, and the French weren't expecting it, and they took it. And there was a lot of bravery on the part of British troops that wasn't equaled on the French side, and except for some of the elite corps. But that's the problem with the conscriptions. So now, on the other side, how they were able to do it, that's another question. And so, because England is such a small country, and it goes into your next thing, why were the Stuarts so weak and the Hanoverians so strong? If we use the term Hanoverian to also include the Dutchman William of Orange and the Stuart Protestants, you know, just the non-valid succession after James II had to flee. So if we as we look at that, the principal thing is the creation of the Bank of England in 1695. And that was a Scot, actually, William Paterson. I mentioned him in episode 4, the last episode of this podcast on the Scottish independence. Paterson was the right man at the right time to do the right thing for the right guy. The British had just lost a major military or a major naval engagement with the French. And William was asking for money from Parliament. There just wasn't enough. Even if he got more taxes, it'd be a losing battle trying to get enough to fight the French. So Paterson, who'd observed how Dutch finance capital had worked, and fractional reserve lending and central banks, and how these institutions can basically create money out of nothing. Of course, it's not really out of nothing. What they do is they underwrite the government's promise to pay them back. So he created this bank that could provide William with all the credit he needed to fight the war. And that's just what they did. And that was the origin of the Bank of England, which is the very model for our own Federal Reserve. And so this is one of the reasons that the Stuarts, when they were restored, were still, as Charles II principally, and then James II, they were trying to rule on the ancient principle of the monarch runs the government on his own purse, but they could not even hope to meet all the demands of state on their own purse, and so they had to constantly go to Parliament. And this is part of the tension between Parliament and the king in that period, and even in things like the Popish Plot, the Seclusion Crisis, and things like that, where the Parliament knows that the monarchy is weak financially, and is trying to move in a direction to force the monarchy in the subservient position. And with the so-called Glorious Revolution, that's exactly what happens. William is in this position where, well, if he's got to fight the wars, he's got to give up X numbers of royal prerogatives. And he does. And so then there you are. So I hope that helps answer that question. I mean, that's probably a podcast in itself. But nevertheless. So now we're going to move on to number two. Anna says, I saw your defense of Voris, and while I have to say it was very well written, I'm kind of dismayed that you took the time. Voris is a super anti-trad, and has compared reading The Remnant to looking at porn. He'll criticize the bishops, but he won't touch the Pope, who does worse things with a 10-foot pole. I also think Voris is like an infiltrator, to get conservatives on his boat and then split them against each other. What do you think about that? Okay, Anna, thank you for the question. Well, that's an interesting one. As far as Voris being an, I know Voris is not a trad, and although I think his critics think he is, but nevertheless, Voris is definitely not a trad. And I didn't take up to defend Voris because, like I even admitted in the post, I don't really watch him because I just don't care for his style. You know, it just smacks me of the whole pop theology, pop apologist that doesn't go deep enough into the tradition. It's not really serious when it comes to real theology, and that's the thing that I dislike about Voris. That being said, however, you know, Voris is under attack. He's being basically being threatened in a very veiled, not so veiled manner, with civil and canonical penalties. And I mean, granted, he is ratcheting up the language, and so he needs to be prepared for that. But you know, so I just said, well, what's the guy really saying that it really deserves this reaction? You know, his whole phrase, "the Church of Nice." I've always liked that one because that's exactly what it is. They want everyone to be nice. Don't say anything divisive. And if you say the truth is divisive. So therefore, you're being divisive. So and that's the main reason that I got to defend Voris, even though he does have a lot of failings, I think, and both in terms of his presentation and even the fact that yes, he won't criticize the Pope for his prudential judgments where he can be criticized. He won't. But he'll criticize the bishops for lesser things. And that's always been the problem. D.L. Hudson was the same way. And although he didn't quite have the cojones Voris has, but, you know, he was like that before his downfall. And others, too. So, you know, so that. But as far as being an infiltrator, I guess it sounds like you mean, is there like some kind of conspiracy that he's being infiltrated? And I guess, frankly, the bishops aren't that smarter, have that much guile to come up with this clever plot to completely destroy the church. You know, I just don't see it, because ultimately, not everything is a conspiracy. It might seem that way sometimes, and you know, I tend to be very conspiratorially minded. When I see things go on, I never believe, especially if it's coming from the mainstream media, I almost never believe it on face value. Not without a little bit of research first. And so, as you can tell, both with my 9/11 podcast and with the second episode of the podcast on the Iraq War, So, you know, so to put it, you know, yeah, it could be. In fact, I saw somewhere somebody was alleging that there's some control on Voris because the person who owns Church Militant TV is actually Opus Dei. Right there. Opus Dei. You know, hey, there we go. You know, definitely not touching that one with a 10-foot pole. In and out without some real evidence anyway. So, yeah, it could be. But I'd like to see some evidence before I went for that. So thank you anyway, Anna. And Jeremy, where are your set of Acantist articles? Those helped a lot of people. Well, it's funny you asked that, because that's actually one of the things I've been working on of late, is trying to get those edited. So those were done, and I had done a fairly good job, but as pointed out, a lot of people have told me, even today, actually, I ran into people said, oh yeah, those articles you did years ago, those are really good for my son, etc. But they did need to be touched up a bit. There was actually one or two points where I argued incorrectly or was wrong on, and I didn't use the right sources. And there's other places where my argumentation needed more backup for the manuals, and so I've been quoting and translating that and trying to get that in play. So and plus I wanted to take certain things out, and then it trailed off into Athenism, and there's another one that becomes a really miserable exercise, and especially with Athenians, because for the most part they don't know the tradition, they don't know what the manuals are, they just simply reject what the church has always taught, namely that theologians, when they're unanimous on a point of faith and morals, that it is in fact infallible, and it becomes a secondary object of infallibility. It means it's so connected with truths of revelation that to deny it is to deny the authority of the church. And there's a few doctrines like that canonizations, for example, that's another one, it's a secondary act of infallibility. So I want to peel away anything where those drifted off into Athenianism, and not all set of Acantists are Athenians too, so I don't want the issue to be obscured. So, and there's a few other topics that I want to test and add to it. In the meantime, however, my former co-author, Philip Campbell, of Unum Sanctum Catholicum Boniface, he has on his website all of my old articles, because I'd given him permission and access to keep putting my stuff up after I'd gotten down, and so after I'd gotten out of it. And so those are all actually on his site if you want to find them there as they were then, before I put the updated versions on, which hopefully I'll be doing shortly. So then let's go to William, who asks, if you ask a question to, I mean, you can provide your last name. You don't have to provide your last name. If you say, don't say this, or you're using a pseudonym, that's fine. But anyway, so William asks, why did you get out of blogging? I really missed you all those years you were gone, and there's a lot of stuff happened. And I'm really glad you're back. Thanks. Okay? So, William, this is actually a bit tricky. But, so some people know this story, very few, but basically what happened is I took a job at a SSPX school, and they have a worry about their employees putting a public face on, mostly because they don't control it. But it was a legitimate point, because here I am, you're a public person in the school, and the kids and, their communities, they don't want you saying stuff that they think could potentially reflect badly on you and on them, as it also could hurt the school, and especially if it's like a blog and you come out and say stuff. And so that was part of it. The other part of it is I got in a spat with some people locally over certain things that I'm not going to go into, and I just don't want to dredge it all up again. And so they felt that I had said things on my blog that were directed at them. They weren't, and it was demonstrable that it wasn't, but that just became an excuse for them to attack. So to make things easier, I had to shut it down just to conform to the prior. And it was just as well, because I had 5 sections of Latin that I was teaching, and I then taught for 4 years, and I was really running out of steam at that point. So needless to say, I no longer work at that particular school, and now I'm kind of on my own doing different projects. So there's nobody that's going to be offended if I, well, there's no people that are offended, but there's nobody in charge of my holding my purse strings that's going to be offended if I write. And so there you have it. And I just decided to do it new because there's a lot of stuff in the old blog on the old site that, you know, it was like, well, it was written when I was younger and, you know, less studied on certain things. And I was like, you know, this just lacks theological precision. I want to get that off there. I don't want my name attached to that. So that's why I didn't put the old Athanasius Contramundum back up. Plus, I wanted to move to WordPress because they had more options there than on Blogger. And all the bloggers really come up since I used it last. But nevertheless, I decided to move it over here. And I'm still contemplating moving it off of WordPress.com and moving over to WordPress.org and site host, which requires a lot more work for me. So I don't know when or if that'll even be done. And my finances are tight now, too, so I can't afford to pay all kinds of new money for hosting and things. Actually, it's not that much, but it's still enough where I got to hold off on things like that. So anyway, William, I hope that answers your question. Next we come to Megan K. Okay? And she says, I listened to your podcast on 9/11, and I have to admit that even though I've never been into that, it totally changed my views on it. It was strange how the issues you brought up started to click for me. Are there any good resources that are trustworthy for more information? There's a lot of nonsense out there, and most 9/11 people I've met are total kooks. Megan, I can entirely empathize, and that's one of the things that kept me away from 9/11 truth for many years, because I met people who just came across as absolute nutjobs, telling me this and that and the other thing, and you know, ranging from Jewish conspiracy to all these things. And you know what? There might be an Israeli element in there, and I don't know if I follow it on any level of Jewish conspiracy, but certainly there is an Israeli element and other things. But nevertheless, that gets blown into, you know, going back to when the Jews were booted out of Spain for the roots of 9/11. It's like, okay, I'm getting out of this now. So yeah, there's a lot of nuts out there. I highly recommend James Corbett's work on 9/11. If you go to his website, CorbettReport.com, you'll, you know, it's hard when you first go to the site, but I believe you can search on there. I think you just type in 9/11 to get a lot of things. You know, he's got a lot of interviews with people who've done a lot of research. They're all very good interviews, and that's a helpful tool right there. There's his short 5-minute video, 9/11 A Conspiracy Theory, which is gotta be one of the most watched videos on that subject of the web. Brilliant little 5-minute thing, just logically showing why the government story just doesn't add up. And let's see. There's Loose Change. I think I saw that one several years ago. I don't remember. And it has its virtues and it has its weak points in terms of evidence and demonstration and things like that. And of course, somebody would have to be cutting wood while I'm doing a podcast. And then we had to decide not to do it inside. And let me think what other things I've seen, because I haven't been actively following the things on that issue for some time. There are some other good documentaries. There was a 30-minute documentary from a Jeremy Rees, R-Y-S. He just goes by his nom de guerre as Alien Scientist. I don't know why it's weird things he's into. But anyway, but he did it. He had followed up on the financial crime on 9/11, and it was a good, clear presentation on that. So, so again, it's always good to avoid stuff where people making specious claims that they can't back up or making allegations that there's no evidence to support. So that's an important one. Okay, so now the last one. When I selected John the Evil Neocat. All right, now, I've never called anybody that term neo-Catholic. I don't like it. It's just scholastically dishonest, I find. And so I know it's nice to finally have something you can throw back at them after they called us names for so many years. But it's just, I mean, just apart from finding a new name to call them to irritate them, it's just not charitable. But secondly, when you fix the prefix neo to something, you're suggesting it's, in scholastic philosophy, you're suggesting it's new to the point of not being the same thing. So if you say neo-Catholic to describe those who go to the Novus Ordo or defend the current magisterium or what have you, you're basically saying in a scholastic way that they're not really Catholic. Now, that might be true for one or two, for a handful of people on a certain basis who really know they've departed from the tradition, they think it's great. But and as a whole, I mean, like the neoconservative apologists and in it and whatnot, in the Carl Keating apologetics empire and such things, you know, they're still Catholic. We don't agree with them. We think they're on the wrong track. They might make arguments that we find erroneous on theological levels that just don't sit well with us or what have you. They attack traditionalists for a very long time for expressing their frustration over the fact that the church was treating them like lepers when Pope Benedict said, well, their mass, that traditional mass has never been abrogated, right? So, I mean, there's levels in which we can certainly oppose them, and, you know, but they're still Catholic and they're still our brothers. So that's why I totally don't use this term neo-Catholic. Okay, and they say a lot of times people just assume you do. But anyway, so John the evil neocat says, you are just another traditionalist jerk trying to tear down the church. I saw your Facebook exchange with Mark Shea and Peter Veer, and I think it's disgraceful how you treat such good men of faith. Okay, well, tell me what you really think, please. All I can say here is, anyone who doesn't know, what was it? It was called From the Trad Subculture with Love, where I published a debate I did not intend to get to. I just made a couple of comments and observations on a point that I could throw into a big thing, which is why I got off Facebook and really don't want to be on it. But anyway, with Mark Shane and another fellow named Torquemada, which is the nom de guerre for Peter Veer, one of his usernames, so he can inject things on people knowing who he is. So, and it's centered around whether the Orthodox were in the church. So I just kept... I didn't call anyone names. You can look at that exchange. I have it up. The only thing I took out of the exchange was there was a point I made, and he didn't understand it, and he started going off on something based on a misunderstanding. And then when it was corrected, it was fine. So I just took those particular things out. But and as far as, like, Mark Shaves, you know, when you look at it, he's the only one who comes across as angry. And I said, well, no, let's go back. Where's the authority? Where's the authority behind the statements? Where do we find this in the tradition? And it wasn't there. So... am I trying to tear down Catholics? Well, I'll let you be the judge of that. I try always to conduct myself as if Christ were watching, he would be satisfied with my attempt to defend the church. You know, I don't name call, I don't lambast people, I don't waste time without homonyms and shift the burden to proof. It might happen by accident on occasion where you're just not needed, you know, busy or something like that. But if I sit down and write an article, again, you know, I don't want to waste time with amateur theological work. I don't want to waste time with things that just are not that important. You know, or getting into the mudslinging fest. I mean, there's a lot, if I really want to generate traffic, you know, I could write a post, Carl Keating is a heretic, and go down and all these things where I think Carl Keating is mistaken and whatnot. And I'd be getting the hits left and right, probably. I don't want that. I don't care if I have one person or no people that visit my blog. As long as I can look at that and be satisfied that I'm doing legitimate theological work, then I'm satisfied. So, the, you know, there's even the things I've written against the Pope, and, you know, for some of his statements, for example, when he said, I don't want to convert you, you just find Jesus where you're at. Well, I just took from the tradition to show why this was a bad thing that he'd said and why this was problematic, just from logic and reason. Because, again, I don't have the patience or the time to waste what God's given me and pour it into little ranting things that, oh, why is Pope so evil? Well, yeah, because the Pope is the Pope, and he is, as he is, coming out of the Argentinian milieu. So we have these kind of problems. And, you know, I'm not going to, you know, jump in and start saying stupid things. And so, obviously, John the evil neocat thinks that the slightest criticism of those he thinks are good and wonderful people must be, you know, hellfire and brimstone and hate-filled and everything. And so, well, there you go. I don't have to do this. You know, I mean, I've got my donation button on here, but apart from when I first appeal for donations to get the ad blocker and things in, you know, I've only gotten a handful, like a $5 thing here and thing here. You know, I'm not making bank. I'm not even making enough to pay even, say, any significant bills. I think apart from the money I asked for to pay for the ad blocker and certain things, that ended up being, yeah, it was like around $60. I got it very quickly. After that, yeah, I think I've gotten $10 in donations or $15 in donations. So the... you know, it is what it is. I'm not getting paid money to do this, so I'm not going to spend my time getting on here just so I can go you know, spew hate at church leaders or anything like that. The point of it is to protect, especially traditional Catholics, but also conservative Catholics. If you are scandalized by what's going on in the church right now, and to show, well, it's not the end of the world. And on that score, too, you have Renaissance popes, you have all these popes in the past that were not good popes. And it's important to point out, you know, if there was 24/7 news coverage when Leo X was pope, I think there'd probably be a lot of nutty, crazy things that he would have said. So, you know, the idea that this is somehow novel here, it's the end of the world, you know, we just can't get sucked into that. So, since the neighbor's turning his lawnmower, I will draw this to a close. The only thing I was going to appeal for is, again, if you like the content that I have here and you want to see more of it, I would, you know, pray and ask that if you would consider a donation. You know, I'm not looking for someone to just come by and give me $1 million to blog. And I'm basically looking for assistance to help, because the way I support myself is I have a number of freelance writing projects or other jobs or particular web jobs for particular priests that I've been doing and other things. And I substitute teach. And, you know, none of those things in and of themselves brings in all the money. But cumulatively, it's been enough to pay my bills so far, and I hope it stays that way. But, so in your kindness and generosity, if you want me to continue putting up the work, although I don't think I'll be getting much of a donation from John the Evil Neocat, but nevertheless, you know, if you want to help me continue to devote the time to get this work up, you know, please consider donating $5 here, $10 there, $1, I really don't care. In the future, once I create enough of it, I'm going to offer a subscriber content which will basically entitle you to stuff that I don't put on the website that will be useful, some subscriber content, translations, or once I produce them, free ebooks and things like that. And so I'll keep you updated on when I do those. And if you have questions, I'm sure I'll be doing another one of these at some point. So there were a bunch of questions. I just picked the ones that I thought would be the best ones to talk about. So thank you again for your time and your patience, and God bless you.